Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. It's your host, Brittany, and today I have Joanne Fisher, who is a 70 in Boise, Idaho, and we are actually at Camp Red Cliff Reunion in Utah, and I roped her into doing a podcast, so we're just going to sit back and chit-chat and see where this takes us. So hello, Joanne.
Hello, Brittany. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I have worked for the Community of Christ professionally since 2001. I hold the priesthood office of 70. I am married. I have 2 grown children and 4 grandchildren. I serve the Inland West Mission Center, and I love my job.
Cool. So my introduction with Joanne, a while ago, several years ago, I came across a podcast on Feminist Mormon Housewives, and you and Robin had been talking about women in the priesthood and Community of Christ, and I was still LDS when I heard that, and that was kind of a game changer for me. And so what was it like for you growing up in the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints before women were ordained?
Sometimes it's a little hard for me to differentiate between what was my church and what was my family. So, obviously the RLDS or Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at that time did not ordain women. So that was not something that I ever thought about or aspired to. But I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. So there was, the women's movement was already happening. And I was aware that there was a disparity in my, understanding of a gracious, loving God who cherished all creation and my circumstances within the church. Even though I felt very loved and supported in the church, there were some things that just were not open to me and I didn't expect it to be.
Yeah.
So when I was 12, I went to a congregation in Arizona, and it was the year that I was old enough to be not the kid in a class, but a helper.
Okay.
And I was so looking forward to that, that I went home and I made my own Bible school. And I had these little Bible story books. I knew not to use like Book of Mormon ones, but I got the Bible ones, and I went around the neighborhood and I told people that there was going to be a Bible school. I asked my mom, and I think she thought we were playing it for the afternoon or something. I don't think she had a good grasp on what I was really saying. So the next morning at 10 o'clock, about 15 kids showed up at our front door, and my sister helped me, and we had crafts. We had a class. We had snacks. I mean, we did it. And that lasted for a week. And toward the middle, I do have to say this, toward the middle, like, we ended up with 20 to 25 kids. And my mom is like, oh, my God, I don't have enough snacks. So she called the women of the congregation and said, Bible school is happening. It's happening at my house. And can you help us? And to their credit, and this is very moving to me, they did not take it over. They brought treats and supported, but let me do my thing. And we had little certificates of graduation that we took my mother's very expensive pinking shears and cut out aluminum foil seals. And that was a big thing in the church. What I think was different about that is people thought it was cool and sweet. And I got recognition for having initiative and doing that. What I did not hear, which if I had been a different gender, is you're a 70.
Yeah.
You're going to be a wonderful pastor. You're going to be a wonderful leader. It was just, you're tenacious.
Yeah.
But there was no vision that would go into anything more.
Yeah. Which is really sad when you think about it, because if you've got a little 12-year-old that's already putting together a Bible school, I mean,
right,
there's a lot of potential there.
That's right. And I do feel, I don't know that I realized it then, but if later when I thought about it, if a 12-year-old boy had done that, I think the response may have been different.
Yeah. Wow. And was it something that you wished would have been different? I mean, you said you recognized it and you weren't expecting things to change, mm-hmm. but was there a hope for change?
No, not when I was young, from like 8 to, I would say about 15.
Okay.
But when I got to be about 16 years old, I realized that I could do things, and I had done enough things that I thought were successful that I felt like I could contribute in ways that were not open to me then. And then because of the women's movement that was happening secularly, I was more aware of what could happen for women. And so at that time, I became frustrated. And then I had a couple of incidences with folks who were in leadership, who were males in leadership, where the boys were kind of encouraged, if not spoken to directly, about the possibility of priesthood for them. And we got what I refer to as the handmaiden speech, which was a big turning point in my life, in a direction of frustration and anger. And I became severely depressed. And then I continued with the church until I had my children, and they were both girls.
Yeah.
And that was a game changer for me, because I did not ever know how I could explain to them how I went to a church where they were not fully embraced in all their potential.
Yeah, I can relate to that a lot. Mm-hmm. That it was similar for me too, that it was almost this gradual thing.
Yes.
And then I had two girls, and I had to really face it, whether... Right. You know, if I could put up with this blatant sexism that I saw in the LDS uh-huh. church, but how could I expect that for my kids? So
and
I relate to that.
Did not want to perpetuate that in their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what year then did you have your girls?
I was a young mom. So I had a daughter in 1976.
Okay.
I was 19 years old. I had my second daughter when I was 21 in 1978.
Okay.
So I was in my early to late 20s when they were about school age, and I took a break from the church then mm-hmm. because they were getting old enough to start to ask me some questions about things. You know, they were like your Lily and Sophie. And I didn't have good answers for them, and they certainly were not good enough for me.
Yeah.
And so I took a break from church for a while.
Yeah.
And tried to figure out what to do.
Yeah. So you had these two little girls, and
yes.
I'm assuming that it was, you know, late 70s, early 80s.
76 and 78 that they were born.
Okay.
So they grew up in the second half of the 70s and early 80s.
Okay. And how was your experience then, I guess, outside of the church raising them? Were you continuing to teach them things of the church or about the church or the gospel?
Oh, gosh, yeah. We talked about church all the time, and I've been involved in youth either as the youth leader, or I taught the teenager class, or I did 4 billion Bible schools in my whole life. You know, I mean, you just keep doing things. I continued to teach them, and I avoided talking about why I just kind of smoothed over it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was getting more in my face, because as they got older, you know, we had a woman long ago try to be a presidential candidate, and we had women doing things that were amazing. And it was harder for me to explain why we didn't have women the same thing happening, what was happening in society happening in our church.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a real disconnect there.
Uh-huh.
And it's scary when you've got girls. Cause
it is. And one time one of my daughters asked me why Jesus wasn't a daughter. And that is a unique question. And it's a hard one to answer, that if God loves girls and boys, why didn't God either have a son and a daughter, or why wasn't Jesus a daughter?
Yeah.
And we just went and got some ice cream.
I don't know the answer.
What else do you do?
I know.
What else do you do? Man. So this is all just a few years then, right before 85. So yes. 156.
Yes.
So, did you step back into the church before that? Because I know that I've heard you say that you were at that conference.
I was at that conference. So I had stopped attending church. My parents still attended. And my dad gave me a big rack of guilt about I'm a mother and I need to have my kids in church. And church was important and I should be attending. And I'm telling him that I'm kind of drowning, but he wasn't hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I needed to try harder. And he said, you should go to World Conference.
Oh, wow.
And so I went kind of out of guilt and kind of to please my parents. And because it's always a great place to hook up with your friends you haven't seen for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I went and, oh my gosh, my life was changed. And you know, what was very cool was that I didn't go as a delegate. I just went. So I was able to just sit in the balcony and observe everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I watched the vote happen. This is Joanne getting emotional. And I knew then that I could never leave and that this was the place for me and would be the place for my daughters and hopefully my granddaughters and my grandsons, because this vote not only changed the church for women, it changed it for all of us.
Yeah. And were you expecting the topic of women in priesthood?
I had heard rumblings, and when the document was presented, oh my gosh, I could barely breathe. And there was, you know, the vote was taken, and I could see that it had passed by it wasn't a close vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know how I got from the balcony to a payphone, but I went home and called my husband and said what had happened. And then I called everybody I could think of and said what had happened. And it was a new day. And the real impact of what we had done did not sink in for a little bit until later.
Yeah. So after that conference, did you just immediately start going again?
After that conference, I was rocking it.
Yes.
Because I was so happy. And this was, I wanted my kids to be part of that celebration.
Yeah.
But I also wanted them to see. And it's not like I was immediately ordained, because I wasn't. And it was hard times. And it was an us and them mentality for a while.
Yeah.
The people who supported that and the people who did not. And so I felt like I owed it to the folks and to the early women who were ordained to go and support and be with them, because what we had voted for was going to impact all of us.
Yeah. So what year were you ordained? It's okay if you don't remember.
I do not exactly remember. I think, I know it was March 12th, but I don't know what year. I was 35 years old and I'm 59 years old right now.
Okay. Okay. Awesome. So, what did your ministry look like early on? I mean, what were the things that you were, I don't know which office you were ordained to.
I was ordained to the office of elder first thing.
Okay.
So I was called to that office by Paul Davis. And I remember I was not in shock, because I knew once it was possible for this to happen, that it probably would eventually happen for mm-hmm. me. It's not something that I campaigned for and tried to make happen, but I have been a leader on a lot of levels in the church. And so it wasn't something that was totally shocking. after I was ordained, Paul Davis said to me at one point, you know, when you're the pastor of the Boise congregation, and I thought, oh my gosh, get a life. That's not, I'm not going to do that. And what did I know? Because I was a pastor of the Boise congregation and the district president of the Boise district, and now I work full time for the church. So they were dreams I didn't know how to dream because I had never been able to dream them.
Oh, good way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
So your daughters are suddenly seeing your mom, their mom being ordained,
yes,
and seeing her get fully engaged again in the church. What do you think that was like for them? Did they appreciate the time that you spent doing ministry, or was it a struggle to find the balance between being a mom and...
You know, I will be really honest. It would be hard for me to do what I'm doing now with young children because I travel a lot throughout the mission center. And I am a person who really does believe that if you are privileged to be able to be someone's mom, that it is a sacred trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm not saying you can't work outside the home, and I'm not saying any of that, but I'm saying for me personally, it was a precious time that I wanted to be with my kids. So I could not have done what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But oh my gosh, I was heavily involved in church. They went with me. They did everything with me. And even now, when I go to other congregations to preach, I take my grandkids or other kids with me, because one of the things that I recognized after I was ordained was that I wasn't groomed the way the boys were groomed to do this, to go observe someone in a priesthood meeting or to be with someone in the prep for some kind of a sacrament, or even going to the hospital to give a blessing or administration to someone who is ill.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took my daughters, I take my grandkids, and I invite people in the congregation into ministry with me so that they can see themselves doing it.
Yeah.
Particularly women.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
I guess what impact do you think that has on the lives of little kids that are, I mean, your grandkids that you're bringing to all these things and letting them participate as much as they can?
So once a month on a Monday night, my granddaughter and grandson, as well as other kids in their congregation, work at a soup kitchen.
Yeah.
That when my grandson was 10 years old, he eulogized somebody at their funeral.
Wow.
He went with me. Let me tell a quick story, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So when Jared was about, he's a big guy now, but when he was about 4, I was in the midst of Meade's training and I was going to be flying to Independence. A dear friend, who happened to be the sister of Dave Brock, had terminal colon cancer, and my grandson was begging to spend the night. And I was supposed to be visiting Amy in the hospital, and I was packing and I was getting ready to go to Meade's. And Jared is just begging for an overnight. And I said, I have too many things to do and I need to go to the hospital, and this woman's very ill. And he said, I will be quiet as a mouse. And so we went to the hospital and he understood how serious this was. And I had prepped him that she, you know, there could be tubing and other things happening. And we went to her room. We stopped and he insisted that we bring a pink balloon to her and some flowers, because his mother had just had a sister. So he thought, that's what you did. And the balloon said, it's a girl. So in case she had any question, we were there. And I sat and visited with her parents and with Amy, who was a 50-year-old woman. And Jared sat very quietly. And then he said, I'm so sorry that you have cancer germs. And I've been thinking about what I might do to make you feel better. And he said, do you want to see something that I can do that's really good? And she did. And he started hopping on one foot and she started laughing and he started laughing. And then we were all crying. And when we left, he hugged her as gently as I've ever seen him hug anyone. And he said, this was a good day. And she said, yes, it was. Thank you for visiting me. You really cheered me up. And as we were walking to the car, he said, you know what, Grandma? I'm really good at that. And I said, good at what, buddy? And he said, I'm good at making people feel better. And I think Jesus wants me to do that. Mm-hmm. He continued to make drawings for her and visited her. And she died. But she is a special memory to him. And then when her father passed away a few years later after a stroke, Jared said, you know, I knew Ray. I've only known him since he's had the stroke. And people kind of were talking about his life before and then who he was after. Mm-hmm. And Jared said, he was a good friend to me even after. And so it's important to me that I say that he was my friend and how much I loved him. And so he did. I don't know very many kids at 4 and 10 who could do those kinds of things. And I think he was capable of that because he's seen it and he's not afraid of it.
Yeah.
And neither is his sister. And they are, they're spiritual in ways that I know come from being unsheltered, that people have needs in life and that we are the hands and feet of Jesus.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because when they see their grandma do things like that, and it's such a part of who you are,
mm-hmm.
and then they start uncovering those things within themselves and
That's
realize
right.
that it's part of who they are as well.
That's right.
And if women weren't ordained, think of the opportunities that they would have missed. It would have been
right.
someone else going
That's
to
right.
the hospital or so. Yeah. I mean, the ramifications of what happened are huge, you know?
And, absolutely huge.
And I don't think we realize it yet. So moving on into where you are currently,
mm-hmm.
Have you been in the Boise area then most of your life or
so
your ordained life?
All of my ordained life, I've lived in the Boise area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you were an elder.
I was an elder.
In the congregation. And then what was it like getting a broader call to 70?
Okay. So I was really... Uh-huh. I was very happy to be an elder, and I had served as an elder happily as an elder at a kind of controversial time in the life of that congregation because we had chosen to share our church building with the MCC congregation, which stands for Metropolitan Community Church, and is a predominantly gay and lesbian LGBT
okay.
congregation.
Okay.
That was back in the 80s where
wow.
there were, or 90, actually 90s probably, 90s where, you know, AIDS was still a big issue and people were frightened. And, mm-hmm. And so I just did not think about, I had a full plate already. So
mm-hmm.
considering another priesthood call was not something that was on the forefront of my mind. I really didn't want to be a 70. And I didn't because I know people who know me personally find me to be gregarious, and the 70 are often stereotyped to have a certain personality type.
Mm-hmm.
That you're very extroverted, that you talk to anyone easily. You're just, so in love with Jesus. You just, you know, it's just oozing out of you. And that is not how I saw myself.
Yeah.
And, I am more introverted than people sometimes think. And it's hard sometimes for me to be with a bunch of people I don't know. And so I just go make food or do something that women can get away doing and nobody realizes what you're doing. So I had told Robin Linkhart about the 12-year-old Bible school story.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had done some work together.
Uh-huh.
And then after a telephone call for another thing, she asked me to remain on the line, and she and Dale Luffman presented a call to the office of 70 to me, which I hoped would never happen, and it did.
That's the way it always works.
I know. And I accepted right then. Oh. I didn't say, let me think about it, or that was much, much harder for me to see myself doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm warming up.
Yeah. How long have you been a 70 for?
I would guess about probably 5 to 7 years.
Okay. So the warming up process can take a while?
Oh, that's good grief, yes.
Good to know.
It can take a while, and that you have to be kind to yourself.
Yeah.
And that there are, you know, what happens is that I start comparing myself to everybody else
mm-hmm.
that I've known who was ever 70. And frankly, they were men.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you hear about these people who just, you know, talk about when the 70 would do series and cottage meetings and all these people's lives were transformed by somebody who was so influential and brought people to Christ. And, you know, outside that dang Bible school, that really wasn't me. And so I think I've borne a witness. It was a different kind of witness.
Yeah.
And I wasn't clear how I would fit, but I'm doing better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what does the Office of 70 mean to you now? What have you grown into in that office?
Oh, I like that question. I've grown into my authenticity as a person.
Mm.
And that it's not a job description. It's a claim on me.
Yeah.
And that it's for me as a person to live up to the best of my ability. And being a special witness for Jesus Christ is whatever it is to you out of my own spiritual maturity or immaturity, which is also one of my gifts in a positive way.
Yeah.
I think joy and, the ability to laugh at oneself and to feel things deeply mm-hmm. is a gift.
Yeah. I think so too.
Thanks.
And I think that there, it's a good balance.
Me too.
And I don't know, I'm still figuring out what all the priesthood offices are and what they mm-hmm. mean. And I think that, I don't know, from what I've observed, is that there's not a right way to be a priest.
Right.
There's not a right way to be a 70. There's not right. a right way to be an elder. And every person that gets called to an office brings a completely different mm-hmm. thing, and that their ministry looks different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's whoever they're bringing ministry to needs. So.
And it's having a confidence that God fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
So sometimes I've shown up at things when I was absolutely clueless as to what I needed to bring, except my authentic self. And when I get into it, I can see what I can contribute. And if I have confidence that God's with me, then I contribute what I can,
mm-hmm.
and God fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. It's scary. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's good.
Mm-hmm. But the more you do it, yeah. the more you trust it, and the more you do the work of it, the more you count on it.
Yeah. So let's talk about what you do for the Mission Center.
Okay.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. So I'm the Mission Coordinator, which is sort of a title like being the mom, which anything can fall under that. If it has to do with mission, it has to do with me, and what doesn't have to do with mission sometimes.
Yeah.
So what I do for the Mission Center now is, I am heavily involved in camps and making sure that we have directors, making sure that all the people who participate are trained by Protect the Children, curriculum type things, you know, so that we're all, our programming is consistent mm-hmm. and we have trained people doing it. And I consider what we do at camps some of our best work mm-hmm. and a true gift. And I adore the children of the church. And so this is something that's a natural fit for me. And then I also travel around and support congregations in Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Wyoming. We don't have a congregation in Wyoming on the part, but we have members there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Idaho and Utah, Washington.
Awesome.
So it is the hardest job, I think, and it is the best job.
And so I know that you've also been supportive of the Feminist Mormon community up in Boise.
Yes.
So they've used Community Christ buildings and things like that.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on those bridge building moments, I guess? I mean, and maybe just in the larger Seeker.
Sure. Sure. So I think the work we're doing with Seekers is some of the most exciting work I've ever participated in. And it's where I cut my teeth as a 70 and where I feel like I found work. I could see myself doing it and I could see it kind of turning out. And that was a big confidence builder for me. The other thing is that Lisa Butterworth and some other women in the Boise area who are feminist Mormons have, I've gone to lunch with her. We were contacted, to hold a vigil of mourning with those who mourn when the LDS Church put out a statement about the children of gay parents.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a house blessing for someone with Lisa and some others. And we've had several visitors in Boise who were people seeking. The thing is that there needs to be a bridge building that mm-hmm. happens because it's really scary to go to Community of Christ Church if you're an LDS seeker. And so I'm there. My daughter's there. We have a website. We have all the stuff. But it helps if there's more than one family to help do the bridge work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are working on that diligently now. Next week I'll be teaching a class with Karen Peter about training congregations to be sensitive and how to do that. And so sometimes because of the Latter-day Seeker website, people know each other and that helps. So Brittany, if it's somebody who's had contact with you, and then I say, I know Brittany,
mm-hmm.
then it feels less scary.
Yeah.
Because it's all about relationships.
Yeah, there's a very human side to
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what I think is important. I mean, I've been able to connect people to various congregations.
Yes.
And I am always very intentional about letting, I'm not the one that knows the people in the congregation.
Right.
But whoever I ask, I give them, this is what they need. This is the type of person,
right.
So it's not just, cause there can be a lot of triggers, I think.
I think so too.
For LDS seekers coming to Community of Christ. And so I think finding a good match, whether it's the whole congregation being a good match or
right.
just a person, really important.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's exciting. I think, time soon.
I don't think it's going to stop either. And I think the thing that has been so profound a long time ago, and the experience that they're having now have been somewhat similar. I know what it is to feel isolated in my thinking. I know what it is to feel somehow less than, but not understand why I'm less than. And to just be angry that so many things are defined by your gender.
Mm-hmm.
And now that it's a new day, it's not perfection. But it's so, so, so much better. And I think those similar events in our lives bind us to each other in a way that when I'm doing this work, when I'm doing seeker work, I am in love with the people that I meet. And I want so much for them to have spiritual peace,
mm-hmm.
whether that's with us or not, that I just... Oh my gosh. I mean, I just didn't even know I could love that much, mm-hmm. that many, that much.
Yeah.
But I can.
Well, and I know there's listeners of this podcast who are mm-hmm. lifelong Community of Christ who have never had a Latter-day Seeker necessarily right. come into their congregation. But just by us telling our stories and engaging in conversations online, there's
yes.
huge bridges that are being built because our stories are so similar.
Absolutely.
And when they hear us talk about our religious experience, it feels like what they went through
right.
growing up as well.
Right.
So I think it can sometimes be easy to pinpoint differences and things like that.
Yes.
But there are so many similarities on these journeys that we take together.
Right. And absolutely. And I think, there have been times when I've been disappointed in my church.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times when I know that out of my own ignorance, I have been insensitive about something. And I think what's wonderful in my mind is that our similarities are not just our origin and not just even the experience of being in a religious institution that is a disappointment and unfulfilling sometimes. But that we can, it's even a deeper level than that. It's almost a human DNA something. That suffering is suffering and oppression is oppression. And not belonging is the worst feeling in the world. And that when you connect on that level, then two humans who connect on that level, something divine happens. We are all changed by it. And it is, it's what I have my own vocabulary for a lot of stuff, but it's sort of like spiritual fusion. And that's what I think happens.
Yeah. I think that for me at this point, that's what restoration and even the restoration,
yes.
you know, capital T, capital R means to me.
Yes.
This coming full circle and being reconciled with each other and with God.
Yes. So. And that is a dream. Did you have it as a girl? I didn't.
No.
That these two.
See?
Yeah.
That these two. I mean, we don't even know how to dream this.
Yeah.
But we're in it. Mm-hmm. And it's happening.
Yeah.
And it is something to get excited about. And I so want the future to happen because I want to see what it's like for Lily and Sophie and Josie and Ella and Jared and the kids that I know and the kids that I love. Mm-hmm. And, I'm looking forward to, you know, I stand on the shoulders of many people who got us to this day. And I am eternally grateful. And I hope that someday someone looks back and says, I'm standing on the shoulders of other people. And they're talking about me, who have shaped and formed them. And who knows where we'll be then. I mean, this is just unbelievable.
Well, I think people probably already say that about you.
You are so kind.
No, I'm not just saying that, though.
You are kind.
I can't remember if I've said this on the podcast before, so I apologize if I have. But I did a baptism a month or so ago, and it was Sunday morning, and I was kind of in that frazzled because I was going to be the only parent with the kids. And so I was worried about the logistics of doing this baptism while three kids. And I was getting everything and making sure I had enough clothes. And one of my girls just said, hey, Mom, don't forget you need dry clothes after the baptism so you don't have to wear your wet clothes again. And I was running down the stairs when she said that, and I just kind of paused and thought, holy cow, what is happening?
Yes.
It was crazy. It was a crazy moment to know that here was my 5-year-old daughter reminding me to get my post-baptism clothes.
That's
so
right.
I have dry clothes. And it was one of those full circle moments of this is normal for her. Like,
that's right.
Mom does baptisms and that's normal.
Right.
And that's fine. And that's, you got to remember those dry clothes though, Mom.
Like, and that she's thinking through the process.
Yeah. Yeah. She knew.
That is huge.
Yeah.
That is absolutely huge.
It was kind of a crazy moment for me to realize, like, wow, they really are watching, and
they really are.
You know, so it's a good thing. I guess what areas in the church, or maybe not necessarily specific areas to call out, but what progress do you think we can still make being inclusive, whether it's gender inclusive or racial or sexual orientation or whatever. What places do you think that we still have to grow? Because I know we get excited about where we have been and where we are now.
Mm-hmm. But we're not done.
Yeah, we're not done.
Oh gosh. I would say ageism. That we have older congregations. And sometimes when the youngest person in your congregation is 60 or 70, you think somebody who's 45 is a kid. And you don't want to put too much responsibility on them when if you talk to the folks who are older, they were doing all kinds of things in their 40s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, sometimes I've heard people say, I'm thinking of this person for leadership, but right now they have little kids or going to school. I don't want to invite them into this because I don't want to put too much on, which is very loving. I'm doing air quotes right now. At the same time, well, we need to be aware of their life circumstances. You're robbing them of opportunities to step into leadership if they choose, and it should be their choice, not a paternal system protecting them from themselves. And, well,
it needs to be not all one or all the other. Yeah. That there needs to be some balance there. And sometimes I think that's a place where we make mistakes. So I would say ageism in both directions. Mm-hmm. I think we still need to work a bit on power. And I know you're going to want me to say more about that.
You can say whatever you want or...
And I think we are making strides in how we have people, you know, we have women in the first presidency now and those kinds of things. But I think we need to be aware of inclusion of all kinds of folks in decision making. Mm-hmm. And that complicates things the more people you have involved. But I think the things that we're doing with consensus are much better than the ways we used to do it. And I think healing happens much faster on both sides of an issue once we've done the work of that. But that sometimes I think we are unaware of our privilege. So when it comes to race, when it comes to gender, when it comes to putting ourselves out there, we are not as aware as we could be or sensitive as we could be. Mm-hmm. I think we need to look at our priesthood structure and that we don't want to be hierarchical, but I think we might be.
Human nature tends to do that, I think.
Right. I'm not saying it's not a wonderful sense and that there are calls that are less than others, but I think, I don't know how to articulate this well, but I think we need to examine and re-examine and make sure that we are not hierarchical.
I think it's important for a person in ministry, even if they're not priesthood, to just feel liberated in their ministry. And so
I'm called to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky balance, I think.
It is. And I don't think there's any subversive plot to, you know, have all the power somewhere or something happening. But I think congregations that can delegate power, and that it's not always in obvious ways. I've been parts of congregation where the most powerful person there was the person with all the money, or could be the person who organizes all the potlucks and manipulates some situations, or you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that we just need to be careful that we are wise but inclusive, and that we are open to allowing others opportunity to give input where that can happen.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the goal of Blessings of Community.
I was just going to say, it is our goal.
Something that you realize when everyone is given a fair shot at having a voice or having mm-hmm. an opinion, mm-hmm. We just had World Conference, and that was a new experience for me. And so seeing people get up and vocalize dissent was a very, very new thing for me.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting in our for the Aaronic priesthood, yes. There, you know, was a few times where things got a little heated, and mm-hmm. I was like a kid in a candy shop because I was like, oh right. my gosh, we can say that we don't agree with this, or,
right.
You know, and to kind of challenge that leadership a little uh-huh. bit. And I didn't necessarily agree with the dissent. I could hear them and understand them. And sometimes mm-hmm. they would bring up, you know, an interesting point that I hadn't
right.
considered before. But yeah, I think that having this faithful disagreement and common consent, at the core of all of this, I think, is extremely important. So, yeah.
It's a powerful thing to know that you love each other past your disagreement
mm-hmm.
and that you're bound together through baptism, through commitment, through our DNA fusion stuff that happens spiritually, that causes us to know that in this moment in time, we are in disagreement, but we're in it together mm-hmm. and we're going to stay together, and it will be what it is.
Yeah.
And the commitment it takes to show up as your best self doing that.
Yeah. So one thing I did want to talk about, at World Conference, and mm-hmm. I blogged about this a little bit, but there was a very large void of this gendered tension that I'm used to when I interact with men. growing up in a very patriarchal society that is still very patriarchal, I felt the void of that at conference. And seeing men and women interact with each other truly as equals. And it didn't matter if I was talking to Apostle Richard James or like Bob the Farmer from the Midwest, that I was treated like I mattered. And that was very, very new to me. I'm assuming that it's taken the church a while to get to that point, and I don't necessarily think it's perfect everywhere. I'm not saying that. But have you seen the cultural shift with ordaining women to kind of get us to that place of more egalitarianism in just the everyday unordained life? I guess what my question is how is ordaining women brought the church to a place outside of ordination that is even more inclusive and leveled the playing field, maybe even outside of ministry, but just in smaller ways? Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. And I think I'm following, and I'm hoping I'm about to give an appropriate answer that applies to the question. My observation has been this, that since the ordination of women, and I don't know if that is because of the ordination of women or a natural evolution that would have come over time, the mystique of being called by God to a priesthood office has diminished. So let me say this. When I was a young girl and appointees or apostles or people that I thought were a big deal in the church would come, there would be this kind of fluttery, I don't know how to describe it. People were excited. We used our best dishes and we, you know, we just thought they were like, I don't know what we thought they were. We thought they were something a little more than us, and that they were incredibly spiritual people. And so while we were excited to be with them, we were sometimes nervous about being with them. It was sort of rock star status. I can tell you right now, nobody thinks I'm a rock star. So would you, the mystique, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's gone. That we no longer think that if you work for the church that you are near perfection and that you don't have problems in your family or yourself or that you're never disappointed or in the church or in your colleagues. I think, people have a more honest and authentic idea of who we are. And I mean, we're all trying our best. And I, please hear me say that I work with the best people in the world and that I have the deepest respect for my colleagues. And I am honored and humbled to be associated with them. But we are not to be worshiped. And I think there's less of that, which two things happen in that. When we're allowed to be authentically human and vulnerable, then that gives them permission to be authentically human and vulnerable too. It also empowers their ministry to us. So we're not the only ministers ever. And I think that while, you know, you set healthy boundaries, the reality is we are all part of the human condition. We are all part of this church, and we are all called to ministry in the church, whatever it looks like. So whether you're Stephen Veazey or you're somebody who's considering joining the Community of Christ, but you're attending a congregation there, you're all equally part of it. You're all equally valued. And that helps tear down walls. And when we can own our own mistakes as a human, as a person, as a church, then we allow God to have God's way with us. And I think that's the goal. And I don't think there's anybody who's exempt from that.
So I guess to wrap up, Joanne, what would your final thoughts be, I guess, geared towards seekers or people who are looking at Community of Christ, maybe for a spiritual home, or even a temporary stop on the journey?
I guess what I want to say is that several years ago, I coined a phrase about Community of Christ, and then I read it in something you had posted on Facebook, and it wasn't exactly the same, but I know you're going to know what I'm talking about. So when I was talking about Community of Christ, I said we are homemade church, and I mean that in the best sense of that word. And when I used it as a an analogy of a restaurant.
Okay.
So, like, there's gourmet food that is very artistic and wonderful and a treat and a splurge. And they tend to be tiny portions that look incredible and are plated a certain way. Then there are diners where the sign says homemade pie. And you get things like meatloaf and biscuits and things that people make themselves. That's the food that sustains me. I don't eat gourmet food every day. I go there for a treat. But the food that sustains me is the homemade pie place.
Mm-hmm.
Community of Christ may not be fancy. Community of Christ may not be rich. We are not always slick, but we are real. And we are doing our best. And that we love God. And we love each other. And we are ready to love you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
That human side of Community of Christ, the maybe not so slick side, was what I was drawn to, honestly, yeah. Because it felt real and authentic, and
mm-hmm.
like there was not something that I couldn't participate in. There wasn't that wall.
There was a place.
Yeah.
For all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Joanne.
You're welcome. Thank Hopefully. You. This was really fun.
I know. I'm glad I talked you into doing this. So.
I am too.
Yeah.
I
thanks,
love you,
Brittany. Everybody. I love you too.
Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ.
Probably Grant chiming the bell. Oh.